I got the term sheet the next day from the venture firm, and Vista turned out an LOI within 24 or 48 hours. So what had been a three-month slog fundraising was now, I've got a term sheet from a venture firm to do the next round, and then an LOI to potentially sell the company.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where I chat with Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and business leaders about how they think and how they operate. If you like the podcast, then I think you'll love my new short weekly email, where I distill one favorite lesson from these interviews and throw in some bonus content like a book recommendation or something that one of these great guests thinks you should check out. You can subscribe at psjournal.substack.com for the Pike Street Journal, or just send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com, and I'll add you to the list. On this episode, I met with Aaron Bird, who was recently the CEO and co-founder at Bizible. And Bizible was then acquired by Marketo, who was acquired by Adobe in a landmark deal. And we talked about all that. We went behind the scenes on what it's like to be acquired, the two-year history that led up to Marketo's acquisition of Bizible, how Aaron broke some of the rules of negotiating, and all the emotional ups and downs of going through the process. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Aaron. I'm sitting here with the one, the only, Aaron Bird.
Hey, Adam.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited.
So for listeners, quick disclosure, I was lucky enough to be on your board at Bizible. So you out there listening might notice that we know each other. We're friends.
Yep.
Anything to add to that?
Adam's a great board member if you can get him.
Thank you. Board members don't tend to do a lot of work, but I got to watch you operate and learned a lot from that experience. You're known as an epic grinder. Where does that reputation come from?
I think it comes from you. I think you're starting that. I don't know if there's any other way. Startups take forever and they're super hard, so I feel like you end up grinding.
I heard that Bizible was an overnight success. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. 8 pivots and 9 years later or something, it was overnight success.
Was that the total? 9 years from founding to exit?
8 years to exit and then a year amongst the two acquirers. For me anyway. Most of my team's actually still there, but
fantastic.
9 for me, yeah.
That's great that they've hung around. I want to talk a lot about the acquisition because that's fresh in your mind today and the mechanics and the learnings and all that. But maybe before we go into that, can you give the cliff notes on the 8 years of Bizible pre-acquisition?
Yeah. I'll do a quick summary. We started the company in January 2011, had kind of 5 ideas that we liked at the time and kind of methodically went through each one and realized that the first 4 were all horrible ideas, which took way longer than it should have, which is always the case, it feels like. And then kind of landed on Bizible. We then pivoted twice after that under the same name and with the same team and everything. And then, you know, so 2 years after leaving Microsoft, we landed on what people know now as Bizible and the idea of doing B2B marketing attribution. So it was a long road of really figuring out what good ideas actually look like and pivoting and spending too much time on bad stuff. And it was kind of off to the races. As soon as we launched that, we really knew we were onto something. I think we signed up 40 customers in 6 weeks, something like that, in that early on. We were charging way too little, which helped with that. But anyway, so we raised about $15 million in equity, a little bit like another $4 million in venture debt, and kind of just scaled from 2013 to 2018.
Nice. So that's why you're known as a grinder. All those pivots, all that figuring out what it was going to be, and then another 6 or so years of growing the business, right?
Yeah. It was a long non-linear route for sure.
Right. Yeah. It's very much a winding road. Yeah, I remember one of your first iterations was kind of the local marketing, right? When you were in Techstars, and I remember talking to you. I think that's when we first met.
Yep.
And then you kind of arrived into the marketing attribution, which became, you know, the business, which became the success story that we'll talk a little bit more about. So a lot of people, founders or people who work in companies, will come to a point where maybe they get the chance to sell their business.
Yeah.
There's few IPOs. Well, there's few exits of any kind. So tell us about the acquisition itself.
Yeah. I think the first thing for us was that it didn't happen overnight. So we ended up selling the company to Marketo. And so they were a great partner of ours. And we partnered with them probably 2 years before they actually acquired us, right? So we built a relationship. They are one of the many big players in the space. So Salesforce is another one that we were keeping close and partnering as much as we could. And so I think the first headline for me before starting Bizible and before, you know, starting a company, I always kind of just thought that somebody comes and knocks on your door and you're like, oh, start popping champagne and they're buying us, right? It was really really more like a 4-year road. I mean, we built relationships with both Marketo and Salesforce as kind of two players in the space that most of our customers were using their products. And the whole acquisition, you know, process started really around us trying to get access to their Salesforce and their customer base, right? So how do we get more access to that through, you know, they have LaunchPoint, which is like their AppExchange, obviously through their sales team, through conferences, et cetera. So we got to know the executives over at Marketo through that process. And again, it wasn't the intention of selling the company. It was more, look, they have access to all the people we want to talk to. So how can we work closer with them to get more of that access? And for us, it was, yeah, we got to know the execs, started to get to know the company. And then this was, I guess, 2016, Vista took them private. So they were publicly traded. And Vista, you know, was a very large private equity firm. They have a $10 billion fund, I think is their latest fund. And they buy and sell exclusively B2B software and today SaaS companies. And so anyway, they took Marketo private. And all the relationship building we had done up until that point was quickly, you know, kind of wiped out for the most part. Because what happened, you know, is the founding team and many of the executives left within 6 to 8 months of Vista taking the company private. And then they brought in, you know, Steve Lucas, who was the CEO that was there until we sold Marketo. But a lot of the people that we built relationships with had left. And yeah. And
so that whole first act of building the relationship actually got wiped out when new management came in and there was a new owner. Let's go back on that first phase, which you weren't thinking acquisition at all, but you were building integrations, you were getting to know the executive team. Walk me through the mechanics of that, because lots of people who are building companies out there, they'll probably build an integration with a third party. How did you approach it? How did you pick the people you wanted to integrate with? And then how did you take it a little further to actually have a relationship with their executive team where you weren't just reading and writing from their APIs?
Yeah, I think one thing I'll highlight too in that journey, you know, Marketo, from really the day we launched Bizible, actually in 2013, Marketo had a product that for the most part competed with Bizible. So they had a product called RCA and RCE. There was actually a kind of a product suite around analytics and attribution. They did things a little bit differently than we did, but if you looked at the value proposition, it was very much a competitive product. So I think the first decision we made, we could have said, well, we want to stay away from Marketo because they have a competing product, and how are we going to sell Bizible to their customers when their customers are already using Marketo and they're going to be selling, their sales reps will be selling them the analytics suite from Marketo. We decided to still lean in on the relationship and play the long game of, we believed that, you know, we knew we had the best product at the time and we believed we always would, and that over time, that Marketo would want their customers to have the best product and that we would be able to build a relationship around that. So I think that was the first thing. And, you know, we thought pretty hard about that. And do you want to kind of, you know, open up the kimono, if you will, to somebody that is somewhat of a competitor? Now, Marketo's revenue was, you know, the vast majority, 90%+ came from marketing automation and not this analytics product, which helped the decision. I think if the analytics product was 40% of their revenue, it would have been a lot harder to make that decision. So we started building a relationship even though we had competing products. And I think the best way, if you're building on their APIs, you know, you're an early stage company, and the best way for us anyway to go from, you know, just somebody that's using the LaunchPoint APIs to building a relationship was really through our customers. About 40% of Bizible's customers were also Marketo customers, so that their marketing automation was Marketo. And for us, those deal sizes were a little bit bigger. So it was about 60% of our revenue came from Marketo customers because the deal size was bigger than the other. So we knew that we wanted to build a relationship closely with them. And so we used our customers and partners. So they're like LeadMD, and there's these services partners that do implementations and service work for Marketo. We started to build relationships with them, and then they also would do the same thing for us. So they would do services work, onboarding, things like that. So like LeadMD and Percuto were two early service partners that we had that were also had Marketo's ear. And I think, so the Marketo execs, you know, often are talking to customers, they're talking to their partners, figuring out, you know, who's in market, what are the great kind of new companies out there, or the new things that their customers like. And I think they started to hear about us through their customers. And that's really, I think, where, you know, we were able to kind of get more access than just somebody who's using their APIs.
How did that actually work? Was it purely organic where your customers were going to them and saying, hey, we use Bizible in parallel with Marketo and the value is great and it's complementary? Or was it something that you had to kind of drive and help facilitate?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, there was some organic stuff happening there, but we started to figure out who are the influential people in the Marketo ecosystem, whether it be customers or partners. And that's not a hard thing to figure out. Obviously, they've got awards like Partner of the Year, and you can see which customers they highlight in stories and stuff. So, you know, we went after that thinking like, we want to make sure that we're telling a good story and we have a good relationship with those folks. And then, you know, as we got to know them better, you know, want them to know, hey, is there any way you could help us with this Marketo relationship? So it was deliberate and kind of evolved over time.
Right. So it kind of put you on a different playing field versus the hundreds of people that integrate with them, just calling up the executive team. Your customers were bringing signal and the partners were talking about you. So then when you reached out, you were known to them.
Yeah, exactly. And all of that comes from product too, obviously, right? I mean, I think we really did have the best product in the market. And of course, no amount of you know, deal making with partners and customers is going to be able to overcome if your product isn't there. So I think starting with product and making sure you really have that nailed, or having it nailed for us, was important. And then the relationships followed.
That's an important insight. Was the product advantage appreciated by the Marketo executive team? Could they see how strong your technology was? Could they recognize where it stood out from others in your category and others in their ecosystem?
Yes, it did. A lot of the pre-Vista folks at Marketo had been there a long time, and of course were really passionate about all the products at Marketo, as you are when you work at a company like that. And so I think they slowly started to realize the product was better than the one that was built at Marketo. I think definitely once Vista took over and there was a lot of new management with fresh eyes, I think that helped even more.
So at this point, you're not angling to be acquired or having any acquisition discussions, but you're building relationships and you're adding value for their customers, basically.
And the primary goal, like the number one goal with this relationship was, you know, how do we get access, better access to Marketo's customer base to help sell Bizible into that base, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's the number one thing. We were not at all looking to get acquired. You know, and at the time, I think Marketo had done like one acquisition historically. So it was not a very acquisitive company. I mean, it really was the furthest from our minds at the time.
Okay. So then Vista came in and a new management team came in.
Yeah. The PE playbook in general, and Vista follows this as well. They'll buy, you know, very, you know, strong assets like a Marketo, and then they'll tend to buy a bunch of companies around that to roll those companies up to leverage the anchor tenant, in this case Marketo Salesforce, to sell these additional products. So I knew that. And so one thing that we were a little bit worried about is we had a couple competitors in market that we were beating, but what if Vista decides they're going to do this roll-up strategy, they're going to go buy five companies, and what if attribution is one of the spaces they want to buy in, and what if they were to buy one of our competitors, right? We weren't planning on selling the company, but I was a little worried. We were beating like our next kind of second two competitor, and you know, what if they got kind of to the point where because we were beating them, they wanted an exit, right? And so I was a little worried about that because we had a much better product than the Marketo product, but the other startup that we were competing with had a good product too, right? And so we were beating them, but if they owned the Marketo Salesforce, you know, that would have been a much different story and would have been a lot harder. So as soon as Vista bought Marketo, I kind of operated under the assumption that there's going to be a bunch of churn at the, you know, in the management and executive level, because that happens oftentimes with acquisitions like that. And you know, the CEO of Marketo was the founder, so he had been at it for a long time. So I assumed that, and then assumed they were probably going to do a roll-up strategy. So I immediately tried to get in touch with Vista. That was, it became my number one goal. Like, you know, I always, as a CEO of Bizible from day one, there was always like one thing that mattered 10 times more than number two, right? And what was that one thing I was focused on? And it became that. How am I going to, I want to meet the folks at Vista. I want to find out kind of how are they thinking about the strategy? Are they going to roll things up? How do they think about MarTech? What are their timelines, right? Because again, 60% of our revenue was coming from customers that were using Marketo, and there was this huge shift going to happen potentially in strategy there. Mm-hmm. So I worked to my network and got in touch with, you know, one of the partners at Vista that led the Marketo deal. And that was within maybe kind of 2 months of them buying Marketo. And I think that in the end, that ended up being something that was definitely a kind of a pivotal moment in the whole history, even though at the time I didn't, you know, think that it was going to matter that much.
And how many years was that before the acquisition actually happened?
Yeah, so that was
still kind of quite
a
ways.
2 years.
Back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was right after they bought it, which is, I think they bought it in like spring of 2016, if I remember right. So okay. It was about 2 years before they acquired us.
But that was a moment of foresight where you said, hey, I have to at least be in touch, or I have to at least know where they're going or understand their strategy or know what this change means for me,
yep.
Given that you had 60% of your revenue kind of tied to their platform or their yep. channel.
Yeah, exactly. And when we would do, if you asked my sales team, like, what's the number one thing you want to see in a customer? It's that they're using Marketo. The leaders, the kind of the early adopters in marketing and some of the most sophisticated marketers were using Marketo. Mm. So it was not only 60% of our revenue, but we saw it as probably more than 60% of our future revenue and growth. So we really wanted to be, you know, defensive about that.
So that first conversation 2 months after Vista had acquired Marketo with the Vista partner obviously wasn't, hey, you should buy Bizible, or he wasn't even thinking about that. You weren't thinking about that. What went down in that conversation, or what did you ask to get information or sort of start to plant the right seed so that you had optionality in the future?
Yeah. The two things that I wanted to understand. So the first one was just the general strategy. So historically, PE firms are known for buying slow-growing, very profitable businesses, and it's about cash flow and earnings and EBITDA in the end for most PE. And I think this kind of shook the tech world a little bit when Vista took Marketo private, because they were buying a company that was trading, you know, at the time in the public markets, I think it was trading about 8x revenue, which, you know, back then that was a lot. Now in today's world, it's, you know, it's not that much, but I was trading at 8x revenue and losing money, right? And so the profile just didn't fit, right, to the general PE playbook. So my first question was just, I'd like to understand, is this kind of a one-off, or just what's the strategy here? It's obviously not an EBITDA, you know, strategy of pull cash out of the business, because that'd be the worst thing to do to a high growth tech company. So I wanted to understand that. And then the second thing was, as it relates to that strategy, how are they thinking about acquisitions? Is this a classic, you know, roll up some of the smaller players and leverage the sales force to sell those products, or not? You know, and if it was, then I wanted to just start getting on their radar around and hopefully try to get some understanding of their strategy and what areas they're looking at. And so that was the goal of the first conversation, was just to understand those two, you know, kind of strategy tenets for them.
Okay. So then naturally my question is, how did that very open-ended, you know, touch base 2 years before you ended up selling to them lead down this road of ultimately you having an offer in front of you that said, hey, we want to buy Bizible?
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, the folks at Vista were great. I'd never met with a partner at a $10 billion PE firm before. I had no idea what to expect. And they were really honest and upfront, and I was surprised. You know, going into that meeting, I didn't have high expectations of them being very transparent and stuff, right? But they were, and so I was a little, you know. So that was great. It was a great experience, kind of early on, and we started to build a relationship over time. Now, at that point, the management, the Marketo management team was still there. Obviously, they had just taken them private, and so I met with them over the next couple months. I met with them maybe two or three times to kind of just start learning more and building the relationship. And then the announcement came out that the Marketo CEO was leaving, which, you know, I thought would be a likely thing. But then obviously the question then is like, well, who's coming in and what's the next story? So I reached back out to Vista. They said, well, give us 2 months or you know, give us a couple months and there'll be an announcement about the new CEO. And when there is, then, you know, let's meet and you can meet that person. And so I think one thing that I didn't think about this at the time, so it wasn't strategy, it was luck, but there's no better meeting to have with the CEO of the most important company in your space than to have their board member introduce you to them in their first couple of weeks on the job, right? And so Vista introduced me to Steve Lucas, who was the new CEO at Marketo. And you know, the route we had taken to meet folks at Marketo before was kind of going up through the ranks, right? And being able to just get an intro to the CEO and start building a relationship early in their tenure was very valuable. And so I met with Steve and he was great. Again, very transparent, very honest conversations. We still were not at all looking to sell the business. It was more about kind of what's the strategy? How are you guys thinking about analytics and attribution? And so we started talks with Steve and the management team around maybe them reselling Visible or OEMing it or co-selling, you know, so basically different levels of a go-to-market partnership, which would then, you know, help us get access to their broader customer base. And then also they would get some revenue in return, right? So 2016 is when Vista bought Marketo. 2017 is kind of, I think Steve came in like the end of 2016. And so pretty much all of 2017 was kind of us exploring those options and looking at different ways that might be able to happen. And there was, you know, executives coming in as Steve was building out his team and starting to meet them. And again, no plans of selling the company, anything like that. The Marketo Summit is in spring. And so spring of 2017, we got a call from Vista / Marketo, from the partner Vista that I've been talking to. And this was, you know, I think 2 months before Marketo Summit, something like that. And you know, they said that, you know, maybe we might be interested in having a more strategic conversation, right? So that was the first time that the idea of selling was ever on the table and we hadn't really thought about it. And so we, you know, we had the conversation. I told them, I think we had 12 to 18 months runway in the bank. We were growing really fast. It was still early. We felt like there's a lot ahead of us. And so, you know, we went back to Vista and said, look, we might be interested, but here's a number and just, you know, don't come in below it, right? I think if we can't get to that number, then we should just end conversation quickly so that we don't waste each other's time. And they were great about it. Vista probably has bought and sold more enterprise software companies than any organization on the planet, and maybe even by an order of magnitude. And so they're pros at buying companies and selling companies both. So they were great. They minimized kind of diligence. They came in, spent about 2 weeks looking at stuff, and then came back and said, you know, we're not going to be able to get to your number. And so it was a great, as far as an experience like that can go, it was very good because it was minimally distracting. It was only me that dealt with them, so I didn't even bring in my executive team because I didn't want people to start to, you know, think we're getting acquired or something like that. And so I was able to help them with all the diligence, and you know, they didn't push or anything, and they just said, yeah, we're not going to get there. Let's continue with our current conversations on partnering. So that was the first time that anyone had ever taken an actual hard look at Visible, right, from an acquisition standpoint. And I think it was an interesting experience. When you first get that call, especially as a first-time entrepreneur, it was an emotional roller coaster just thinking about, like, would we really sell? And I mean, what if they got to the number? I don't know if we could do it. And so it was good to start to go through the thought process for later, because I think kind of the different areas to think about and variables to consider. It was good to have done that for the next round when they did buy us.
So almost all negotiating advice you get says never speak first, right?
Yeah.
But you made a very intentional choice in this case to speak first and to put out a number that was like, hey, if you can get to this point, then
yeah,
we would have a conversation.
What was it that led you to take that tact, and why was that important for sustaining your long-term relationship? Because one thing I take away from this too is after that didn't happen, the relationship remained strong, you remained a key partner, your business kept growing, and you kept talking to them about partnerships.
Yep.
So how did you arrive at that strategy?
Yeah, I was optimizing for two things, neither of which were selling the company or trying to, you know, get to the best possible price, right? So I was optimizing one for minimal distraction, for mostly for me and my team. You know, we were a 80 person company at the time, very tight knit, you know, like many startups are. If we started down the path of an acquisition and it didn't happen, it would be devastating. The morale, you know, swings and everything that would happen there. I didn't want to start something that had any likelihood of not happening. And so I wanted to just be efficient with time. So that was one. And then the second thing was the relationship. I thought that, you know, it seems like it would be unlikely we would sell the first time someone comes knocking on the door. So if we don't sell, I want the relationship to be just as good as it was, you know, yesterday. And so that's why I kind of gave that number, just because I felt like if they gave us an offer that was 20% below that, you know, I'm going to have to then take that to my board. I'm probably have to talk to my co-founders. I wanted to kind of cut it clean and optimize for those two things. I'm sure that wasn't the best negotiating position, but it was, you know, I wasn't optimizing for that.
Well, yeah, it's like you said, you weren't actually optimizing to sell. You were optimizing for the long-term relationship and answering that question of kind of, were they serious right now at think numbers that would make sense. This is a super interesting dynamic because I remember watching it from the board side, and the whole thing, it did happen incredibly fast. Like they took you came back to them, they took a look, the whole thing was lightning speed, no distraction, and you kind of went on with life.
Yep.
At that point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And so then, you know, a year later, you ended up selling. How did it end up coming back to that discussion of acquisition?
Yeah, this is another grind. So January 1st, 2018, we've got about, I think, 8 or 9 months of runway in the bank, and we're going out to fundraise. And the business has never, the business has been doing better than it's ever been before, right? I mean, I'm more optimistic than I ever was before. We had done 2 venture rounds before that, and as far as I was concerned, the business was way better than either one of those previous rounds. And so I kind of thought that we were going to be able to, I thought raising was going to be kind of the same level of effort as the last 2 rounds were. And not that it would be easy by any means, but that we would be able to get something done and, you know, and in a reasonable time frame. As it turns out, you know, MarTech, the MarTech 5000, Scott Brinker slide, for those of you that know that, was finally starting to take its toll on, you know, venture capital funding. And I think VCs were a little hesitant to MarTech. So it was actually, you know, we went out to fundraise and I was just surprised how hard we had to work and how many people we had to talk to before we got a term sheet. So I think so that becomes a variable later when thinking about selling. So I go out to fundraise. I talk to, you know, partners at lots of firms. I think I was fundraising for about 2.5 months. And I'm talking to this firm, and it's Monday morning, and they have their Monday partner meeting that Monday, and they email me, and the partner there emails me and says, you know what, we're going to issue a term sheet, and I'll get it to you tomorrow. We're just going to meet in our partner meeting to figure out the final details for the term sheet. And so I'm excited. I like the firm. I like the partner. It was a slog to raise, harder than I thought it was going to be. And you know, I actually want to have this conversation with the folks at Vista to see. The coincidence just seems unreal. But I get an email from the partner at Vista at like 4 o'clock that Monday. And he's like, you know what, let's have a conversation. I want to talk about, you know, kind of the direction or what, you know, what's new. And I'm like, okay, well, how about we talk, you know, now? He's like, sure. So we get on a call. And I tell him, you know, he's like, how's the fundraise going? And I'm like, well, I'm expecting a term sheet this week. And he says, well, I think that we went out and looked at the market, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that you know, we want to talk to you again about buying you, right? And I think actually on that call threw out a number, which was like in the right zone. And in fact, I think the number at that point was higher than the pre-money valuation on the investor's term sheet for reference. And so, or that we were going to get the next day. So anyway, I was like, well, that's great. We'll need to move fast because I've got a, you know, investor, I'll have an investor term sheet here soon. And so I got the term sheet the next day from the venture firm, and Vista turned out an LOI within, I think, 24 or 48 hours. So what had been a 3-month slog fundraising was now I've got a term sheet from a venture firm to do the next round, and then an LOI to potentially sell the company, and both kind of open, and they both knew about each other. So I was, you know, I told both of them what was happening. Again, I wanted to keep the relationship in both cases. And so anyway, very much a roller coaster from, you know, wondering if we're going to be able to raise, and possibly even talking to my insiders about what would we do and how much, you know, what would they fund? And they were all ready to fund if we weren't going to be able to raise. Going from that kind of conversation to now we've got, you know, an LOI and a term sheet in front of us.
Right. So at the point when you were expecting the term sheet from the VC firm the next day, had the idea crossed your mind that you'd possibly be selling the company instead of raising money?
No, not at all.
So that was it is quite a coincidence that he called your message to you that day. Like, you almost think they had to have some information coming in from somewhere, but it could just be that that was actually the timeline where they analyzed the market and said, oh, actually, Aaron, we do want to talk to you about the company now.
Yeah. I think the general timing, companies want to announce acquisitions at their conference. And so they'll do their acquisitions, you know, a few months before the conference. So it was the season to be, you know, for Marketo to be looking at buying something. But the timing with that day was just crazy. I mean, I think that, you know, venture VC associates are out having beers, you know, in San Francisco every night, and there's like the word on the street and everything. So I don't know if that played into it, or maybe after 40 years of buying companies, you develop a sixth sense that Vista has. But anyway, the coincidence was notable, definitely.
What was the emotion like in that moment when you're now sitting there with this offer to buy the company, right? This opportunity to raise a large amount of capital and like run to the next stage. Some of the other conversations you're having maybe with your insiders about other options you could create. What were you feeling at that moment?
Yeah, it was all about the team, really. I mean, as soon as I knew that, you know, we could get a round done, which was the main thing I cared about at the time, the question was, what if we sell or not, what is this going to mean for the team and how do they think about it? So as soon as I got that LOI, I talked to my two co-founders and I wanted to get a read on where their head was at. That was, you know, and then also talk to them about how do we think the rest of the team would land or think about this and that kind of thing. So I think that was the number one thing about, because the decision was, do we want to sell the company? Like, we now have the option to fundraise and do what our plan was yesterday. And so the real question was, is this the right time to sell? And the team was kind of the biggest variable there.
Right. And of course, there's financial variables that you're looking at, like how much is this going to return to our shareholders versus what we could do if we kept running, and what's this mean for our employees? What were some of the other variables that you were talking about with your team there, or the questions that you were asking that were helpful in having that dialogue? Because it really did flip from, well, yesterday we were about to, you know, raise money and keep doing what we're doing, and now today we have this other option.
Yeah, I think the first reaction was the team. There's lots of stuff that follows once this whole idea starts to sink in. But if my co-founders said, no way, let's not do it, then I think I would have walked right there. You know, so like that was the first check. And it was interesting because I met with them separately, and they both, in the initial meeting, of course, this is the first time they're hearing about any of this possibly happening. So they're having to think on their feet. They both said, no, like let's not sell. You know, that we should keep going. Like, we're amped. We, you know, let's take the money. Let's take the fundraise. And the next morning, they both came to me and they're like, I think we should sell. So it was funny, just the initial reaction was no, and then like sleeping on it, they're like, I think we should do this. And but they both were open to whatever, right? I think they were like, you know, their bias was let's sell, but you know, if everybody else wanted to keep going or whatever, they were open to it, right?
Yeah,
which was good.
What was the emotional case against selling? Not the financial case, not the metrics, not the numbers, but what was the emotional case against it that they initially like knee-jerked?
Well, just that Bizible, the standalone company, this thing we've been pouring our blood, sweat, and tears into, like wouldn't exist, you know? I mean, and even, you know, there were employees that, you know, after we sold that had that same reaction, right? Like that it was like, it was everyone's baby, right? And if you sell it, it that changes things a lot. So, I mean, I think that was the emotional piece for all of us, was just this realization, right? That thing that we all kind of got together and stacked hands to go do, like that mission's over, right? And there's a new mission, but that thing's over. And so that was a big, it was hard.
Right. And there was a mission you'd been on for a while,
yeah,
8 years.
And exactly. A grind, if you will.
A grind. What was the emotional argument that they came back with the next day to sell?
I think that it was, I think different reasons for the two of them, but it has been a grind, right? And it had been like 8 years and things were going really well, but you know, maybe there's an opportunity to switch gears here, right? And yeah, but again, they weren't, you know, none of us were like dead set on it for sure, but more, I think their bias was to sell, but they would have been happy, you know, continuing on.
Well, it was a crazy moment to be part of and how quick it came together. And then you did this whole deal and got it announced at the conference.
Yeah.
And then an even crazier thing kind of happened, what, a year later? Like worked there. They did a great job integrating your product and selling it to all their customers. And like Bizible lives on today in a very meaningful way. So 6 months later, then an unexpected event happened.
Yeah, it was crazy. So after you sell a company, or you start integrating it, right? And so we were in the process of integrating Bizible with Marketo. And so as part of the acquisition, I took the job to run product at Marketo. And maybe 2 months after the Bizible acquisition, Vista was now potentially going to sell Marketo. And so I was now in, you know, pitch rooms with various strategics around selling Marketo to them. We knew that Vista probably wasn't going to hold on to Marketo forever, and they were probably going to sell it at some point, and that's the PE playbook. But in no way did I know that within 6 months or even a year that Marketo was going to get sold. It was from, you know, April 2018 to April 2019 was just a crazy, crazy ride.
And remind me the headline on that acquisition, because I can't remember the exact number. It was so big.
$4.7 billion.
And was that the biggest or top five biggest SaaS app acquisitions?
I think it's the top five. Yeah. I think Concur was six or eight or something like that. But yes. Yeah.
And Qualtrics was really big recently.
Yeah. Well,
but that
Qualtrics
was after.
Came afterwards. Yeah.
Right. So at that time.
Yeah. It was maybe top even two or three. So yeah, really a very big acquisition.
So and Adobe came in and did that deal, and that got a lot of news.
Yeah.
What were some of the learnings from that process? Because now you sold your company, right? Which is a high growth venture backed company that sold to a much bigger company.
Yeah.
And you were part of that much bigger company selling to a behemoth in Adobe with a kind of landmark deal. What was some of the lessons that you took away from seeing that happen?
Yeah, I think that, so first thing that was just, I guess, surprising is that it seems like it doesn't matter how many zeros are on the check. The process is basically the same, which, no, I mean, there's, you know, there's more diligence, there's more people in the room, there's more money at stake, obviously. But I was just surprised how similar kind of both of those were back to back. And I think that, you know, once an acquirer, once they flip in their head that I'm going to buy this thing from a, you know, a no, or maybe to yes, it's, you know, I want it to happen, then it's just this, you know, getting through diligence and everything as fast as possible. And, you know, both deals, the process went very quick. And so anyway, I was surprised by that, just how similar they were. I think that one thing that I learned, you know, at first, when we were talking to Vista about selling Bizible, I was a little intimidated or worried. I'm going to sell to this, you know, I'm selling to Marketo, but owned by this PE firm that buys and sells companies for a living, right? I mean, they're as good or probably better at that than I am at building software. And so I was a little intimidated thinking, you know, they're probably going to be able to get the best deal and they know what they're doing because that's all they do. But one thing that I realized is that if you sell to someone that buys and sells companies for a living, the thing that matters the most to them is their reputation, because that without a good reputation, they can't buy and sell companies effectively, right? So had we have sold to a company that had never bought a company before, had no reputation on the line, it actually would have been harder, I think, than selling to Vista. There were just many things along the way, both when we sold to Vista and also when we watched Vista sell, you know, Marketo to Adobe, that I think it's actually advantageous because they have to, again, their reputation is everything to them. So I think one thing going back, you know, if I did this again, I'd almost be more leery of selling to a company that had never bought companies or sold companies before versus someone that has their reputation on the line every time.
Right. That's a good one because you basically want to be playing games with people who are also playing the long game.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And otherwise, then you could be at a disadvantage and they might do shady things or come at you in a way that's not productive for the long term.
Yep.
So that's super interesting, right? Because people might think, oh, private equity, they're sharks, they're going to like optimize or kind of get me into a bad position. But the reality is their reputation is kind of number one because of their long-term goals with their business.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And if they had issues with their reputation, then the next time they tried to sell a Marketo to Adobe, they wouldn't be able to, right? And it would cost them a ton. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. It was the opposite of what I thought going into it. And having seen both sides of Vista buying a company and selling a company, it was definitely true that they, you know, they were playing the long game and like didn't sweat the small stuff, which was nice.
So that overnight success right there for you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, overnight success.
Well, now that you had your overnight success, you know, after 10 years of grinding, you took a little time off and you're going to jump right back into it, I heard?
I'm going to get back into it for sure. Yeah, I think that I'm being methodical while picking about what I'm going to do. But yes, I'm definitely going to go do something again.
Why are you motivated to go back and do something again and found another company?
I think of it as like I want to go do something for, you know, my the rest of my career. So call it the next 30 years. I want to find a big space and go build something big and lasting and spend, you know, as long as I have left doing it. I think that, you know, having had some success and an exit or two, I think helps to be able to allow me to do that, right? And be able to swing for a very far fence knowing that.
Yeah. So how are you approaching the whole founding process differently then in order to, you know, both take that really long-term view, like I want to do this for 30 years and also knowing that you need to be in a giant category that can sustain you for that long.
Yeah. I think the first and biggest difference with Bizible, we focused on markets we knew because it made sense. That was the fastest way to product market fit is to focus on places where we had domain expertise. And so that limited our search space, if you will, right, on ideas, which I think was definitely the right choice at that time. But this round, I want to focus on, regardless of like where my expertise lies, I want to look at where do I think the big markets are going to be in the next 30 years.
So what are the categories that you've narrowed down to now?
I'm now focused, I think, on just climate and how and kind of the AI enterprise.
Big ones.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're taking your time to really kind of dig into these markets. And that is an interesting pivot, right? Going from, hey, here's things I know really well, where you don't actually have to learn the category, where now you have to go back and sort of start with first principles.
Yeah, exactly. And the next step, once kind of picking a market, is obviously the exact same thing we did at Bizible around do customer discovery, do customer development, like find pain, right? And I think of that as like you're doing a local search for the local maxima in that space, right? And the first step is where's the global maxima? What space will the global maxima be in? And then go and search that space for the local maxima.
So are you enjoying this process?
I am. Yeah. It's kind of hard to not jump into things. Like as a optimistic entrepreneur, I've probably seen four things that if I hadn't promised me myself and my family that I was going to take at least a year to year and a half before, like, you know, diving back in, I probably would have jumped into one of those. So it's been a good forcing function to keep me at bay, if you will. But yeah, I think it's fun. I'm learning a lot, if nothing else.
It's gonna be fun to watch. Let's wrap it up with the Supersonic Six.
Okay.
So these are rapid fire questions. Take as much time as you want to answer, but I won't do much follow-up. I'll just move on to the next one. So number one, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
I think it's just more turns at the crank. So, you know, there's the we need more angel investors camp, and there's the we need more entrepreneurs camp, and there's, you know, we need more VCs. I think that, yeah, if you look at Silicon Valley, you have this virtuous cycle of entrepreneurs that exit with a good outcome, have money, and then when they go meet, you know, when an entrepreneur meets with, you know, whatever, Reid Hoffman or something, and he tells them, I think this is a great idea. I think you're going to be the next Mark Zuckerberg. That helps, right? Like that person starts to believe they're going to be able to do this. And of course, the cash they get helps too. So I think that once you've seen success, you then have the belief it can happen, right? Both as an entrepreneur and an investor. And so I think we just need more big exits that then that money and that confidence and that belief then like feeds the ecosystem.
Is that crank, turns of the crank, of Jim Collins flywheel reference?
Yes.
I love it. All right. Number two, if you could go back to the beginning, would you still found your company in Seattle?
Yes. Yeah. I have to because my wife won't leave. So that quickly shortens the debate about all the other issues.
Perfect. Number three, who's a Seattle company or founder that you're following or studying right now and why?
I think Robert at Highspot. Yeah, it was cool because they got seed funding from Madrona right after we did. And so I remember meeting with Robert when, you know, maybe they had a few customers like very, very early. And so it's been just really cool to watch that journey. And I think they're really onto something. They're an interesting space. And Robert's just an amazing CEO. So
yeah. Robert Wahabe, Highspot. Yeah, they've really turned it on recently, I think, getting the enterprise motion going and their category kind of caught fire. Fun to watch them here. Number four, what do you believe today that goes against conventional wisdom?
Yeah, I feel like most things I believe go against conventional wisdom. Well, I believed for the last 3 years that the market was going to tank. That at one point was against conventional wisdom, although in the last 2 weeks, maybe that's changed. Yeah, maybe I'll go with that.
Okay. Number five, what's a discovery or learning you've had recently that surprised you?
How complicated the climate space is. Yeah, it's like 10 times more complicated than quantum physics. I mean, it's the breadth and depth are just crazy.
Very cool. Can't wait to hear more about what you learned digging in there. Number six, what's a book that has had a big impact on the way you think?
So it's a lesser known one, Fifth Discipline. It's about systems thinking. So yeah, it actually completely changed the way I think about stuff. And I think it really changed the way I think about organizations and as a CEO, just making sure that everybody has a voice and you understand how your decisions impact everybody in the company. And I think it helped a lot with managing big teams.
As we wrap up, what can this audience do to help you? Is there anything you need from the community as you launch into your new unnamed startup journey?
If you're interested in AI or climate, reach out to me. I'd love to chat with you.
All right. So you're building a team. You're looking for people.
Well, I'm at this point, I'm not assembling a team quite yet, but I'm definitely networking with people that are interested. I want to learn from folks and, you know, pretty soon I'll start to build a team.
All right. So now people can get ahead if they want in. They can get early access. Thank you, Aaron. I love your story. I loved being a small part of the Bizible journey. Always learned a lot from you and appreciate your insights. Would you like to drop the mic? Boom. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Is it on? I think it's on. Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.